Hello and welcome to the Grand Cinema Hotel, a podcast hosted by two friends who love cinema. Tonight you'll be staying in room 177, The Player, a comedic mystery directed by Robert Altman. So go ahead, get comfortable and throw on that Do Not Disturb sign as we sleaze it up with the studio exec in The Player.
From director Robert Altman comes a story of Hollywood.
I got a writer in here who's got a pitch I think you ought to hear. I think it's hot.
We open outside San Quentin.
The Graduate, part two. And Mrs. Robinson had a stroke, so she can't talk.
It's gonna be funny?
Yeah, it'll be funny.
Griffin Mill is a hotshot studio executive.
Yes.
Angelica, Griffin Mill.
Oh, hi.
Good to see you.
Malcolm McDowell.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Berg.
Good to see you.
He's heard every pitch.
That's exactly right. It's Out of Africa meets Pretty Woman.
He knows all the angles.
We're gonna have to have a little sex in this mystery.
Okay, sure, of course. We'll get it.
Slowly pushes her panties down to her knees.
And all the players.
Players, and thank you for checking back in to the Grand Cinema Hotel. As always, if you're listening on YouTube, make sure you like and subscribe as it helps the show out a lot. As always, I'm joined by Alvaro.
What's up, guys?
And we're here to talk about a fucking banger today, honestly. We're back in the old movie bag. I don't think you've been to the movies this week, right?
No.
I went earlier this week. I saw Ninja Turtles, which I thought was very peak, very good. I enjoyed it quite a lot. But we're here to talk about just a fucking classic, a really great movie that is newer to both of us.
But yeah.
I feel like this is one that I've heard a lot about over the many years of listening to other podcasts and many YouTube videos alike. And this is one that's always just kind of been floating around for me, but I decided it was finally time to tackle it. And I saw this movie like a month ago already, and once I saw it, I just knew that this was something that was going to have to be brought to your attention, and that I just knew you were going to like this movie before I even told you about it.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, where to start with this? I think there's always been an interest, obviously, for Robert Altman, and I think, like you said, with you specifically, since you like Paul Thomas Anderson so much, and obviously I do too, but you've always talked about Paul Thomas Anderson's love for him. And also, I think, obviously, in the making of this podcast and stuff like that, there's certain directors that you start seeking out because you start kind of figuring out what your style is or why you like Quentin Tarantino, why you like Paul Thomas Anderson, or why you like Nolan. And then
the Safdies.
Yeah.
They're hugely influenced by Robert Altman.
And, you know, do you go and visit the masters, as Scorsese says, and this is one of them. And I honestly, like you said, this is really new to me because I've only watched Mr. and Mrs. McCabe. So that's obviously completely different to this. It's almost like a 15-year difference.
Wait, it's McCabe and Mrs. Miller, correct?
Yeah, sorry. And that's like a 15-year difference, I'm sure. So it's obviously, I think, the great filmmaker in him is still prevalent through the both films, but this was something that I think to kind of compare it to something, I think, is like when I first watched Dr. Strangelove.
Really?
Like, that's how I felt watching this movie, where I was like, it felt like it was I didn't know about this, and now I really know. I know about this, and I think I'm gonna love this. You know what I mean?
I get you.
Yeah, like I was like and almost like you said. Sometimes we talk about the first time we watch a really good movie, you have to like sit on it for a bit because you're like, I know, I like, you know, this is really, really good, but in terms of, being like, no, I like really like that. You know?
Yeah, for me, it was like you know, the famous opening shot in this movie. It's 8 minutes, no cuts, right?
Mm-hmm.
I had no clue about that at all, honestly.
You didn't tell me either, yeah.
Yeah,
so
I definitely was like, I'm not going to say anything. I just want him to see it, right? We love a good tracking shot, right? I mean, a lot of our favorites have done them from time to time. And there's always, you know, it's funny because this movie, the opening tracking shot is also discussing great tracking shots in movies, right? But then, like, one of the microcosms of this movie that once you get into it is like one of the guys who's talking about movies, you realize he doesn't even watch that many movies. You know what
yeah.
I mean? And like, if that ain't just like hitting the nail on the head, right? But getting to my point about that tracking shot is I was watching it the first time, and I'm not going to lie, it was just like a lazy Sunday. I was in the mood to watch movies, so I was like, you know what? I'm finally going to throw this on because I want to dig more into Robert Altman. But I wanted to see it. So then this tracking shot starts, and I'm laying on the couch, and then I'm sitting up like in my gamer pose halfway through, right? Because I'm like, holy shit, I'm looking at – I hit the menu, and I'm like, okay, this has been going on for a while, right? And then you just see how it's just so well done. And like we talked about with Ari Aster, Martin Scorsese, the idea of like understanding the cinematic language, right? And if this isn't proof right here that Robert Altman is just a master of his craft in every way possible, that I don't know what to tell you, you know, like this is everything right here. And it's a great setup for a really wonderful film. And the thing is about this tracking shot is not only is it so well crafted, it lays out almost the entire movie for you, and not the plot, but like the things you're going to experience. You know, like one of the great ones is the guy who's pitching The Graduate 2, right?
Yeah.
Which is funny because it's like every pitch you hear in this movie is, in my opinion, and yours too, was a bad movie, right?
Yeah, it's terrible.
It's just a really terrible movie. And then you get, you know, you have all these studio execs, and you're just kind of like, these people don't really seem like they're that into movies, to be honest, right? And transitioning into Robert Altman a little bit, because you brought up McCabe and Mrs. Miller and that gap in time. This was considered by Robert Altman himself his fourth comeback, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because he is also part of that Hollywood new wave renaissance that happened in the 70s. But he was kind of old already. I don't know if you know this. He was already 40 years old in the 70s. So this is not like a young man, you know? He's about 60-something when he's making this film. And what better guy to make such a like scathing fucking satire, very, very prescient to like the times today,
right? Yeah.
And it's like, and this guy has been going through this forever, and it isn't just Robert Altman. I mean, this isn't a new thing. This is kind of like a, since movies have been invented, basically these problems have existed. But I do think that this is like crystallized into like the perfect symbol of like the ugly side of Hollywood, right? And I also think too, because I saw Robert Altman say this in an interview, that this isn't just a criticism of Hollywood. This is a criticism of society, the society we live
exactly.
in. You know, that what kind of world do we live in where these are the heroes in our stories, you know, and like these are the people that we glorify, and it's not what they do. It's just how much money they make, and we don't glorify the creative. And it's funny because this movie in no way, shape or form glorifies the creative. It's all about the businessman.
Yeah. I did like that you say how prevalent it is now, obviously for various reasons, but I think that is why I felt like Dr. Strangelove as well, because when the comedies are really well done, and we always talk about like absurd ones like that we really like Wayne's World or, you know, Airplane, but like ones that are made by directors that are transcend eras, they're still prevalent always and hit really well. And yeah. Dr. Strangelove is like that, and so is this movie. So I like that you brought that up, because it just at a time where it feels, you know, we've talked about the execs right before the show, the kind of stuff that they've supposedly anonymously said, you know, are what you would expect the people that come out in this movie to say. And like you said, it's not like making movies is a new thing. So this has always been an issue, but this could have been done in a way by somebody else where it would be very aged. And I don't think this film, besides obviously not having cell phones and stuff like that, is very aged. I still think it's just hits everything that's going on right now, like the nail on the head, which is, I think, perfect timing for us to talk about this movie, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, this movie, we haven't really gotten into the strikes or anything like that and what's been going on. I mean, obviously, you know what side we fall on with these kinds of things. Right? Yeah. I mean, we're movie lovers. We're not studio lovers or executive lovers. We love the creative side of filmmaking. And yes, I understand that the business side is absolutely necessary because at the end of the day, as much as we would love for this to just be seen as purely art, it can't be. It can't exist the way it does without the commercialism. So it's a double, you know, what do they say? It's a double-edged sword, right?
Yeah.
You just have to have this side of it. And I think this is another reason why, you know, not to rotate and gyrate on it too hard, but Neon and A24 and why we like these kinds of studios, because they can still get the job done within the guidelines of, you know, I don't know, human decency.
Yeah,
you
know what I mean? Exactly.
I'm sure, you know, every studio has had an issue here or there where, you know, A24 and Neon have probably done something cancelable, right? But the overall product of what they're putting out, I still do believe is art driven.
Yeah.
And I don't believe that from Universal or Warner Brothers or Disney, you know, Netflix, whatever. I don't think any of them really give a fuck about the artistic integrity of what they're making, you know? I do think that when a movie like Oppenheimer comes out, it's just a bonus that it's a good movie, you exactly. know? Or Warner Brothers with Barbie, like, it was just like, oh, nice, cherry on top that it was actually good and people liked it. It wasn't just... I honestly can't say if the Barbie movie was... the idea of making this movie was with good intent. Probably not, you know?
Yeah.
And a director like Greta Gerwig is able to turn corporate IP bullshit into a heartwarming story. But that's on her. That's not on Warner Brothers, you know? There's no way that's what Warner Brothers was actually going for, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I mean...
And the same thing with Disney, too, and all of this, like, all the stuff with Bob Iger, like... They talk about actors and directors right now working like Michael Mann. You know, they want to call him a scab for crossing the line, but why the hell would anybody want to be in a Marvel or Disney movie after this, right?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like they were giving him shit for doing it, but then now you find out that it's because he's able to work with a studio that is, you know, agreeing to all the terms that everybody wants. So, I mean, he's really obviously trying to push his... movie, but I do think that it's because it's not, he's been lucky enough to find a solution, right?
Michael Mann, right?
Yeah, Michael okay, Mann.
Cool, because I want to make sure you're not talking about Bob Iger.
No, Michael Mann. About, like, yeah, like you said, because people were giving him shit, right, for crossing.
Yes,
yeah.
that's who I was referring yeah. to, is Michael Mann. But talking about Bob Iger here, who I'm sure probably owns this podcast somehow, right?
Yeah.
You know, these quotes about that are coming out that, you know, Disney wants to, how do we use AI to write our stories? How do we, I don't know if you saw this, WandaVision, the extras in the background, they scan their faces so they could put them in the backgrounds of things without actually ever having the person show up. You know, just totally removing any kind of humanity from their projects, you know, and we should have seen this coming with the de-aging, you know, the Carrie Fisher stuff, where they're just putting a literal dead person in their movie, right? And even, you know, we talked about The Flash a bit, but I feel like Nick Cage's Superman is just like the ultimate, like, just ultimate kick in the nuts, you know? And it's like, here's this reference, here's this AI reference to something that never happened, actually.
You know what makes me most mad about that is that they're trying to profit off of an idea they squashed that they thought was a shit idea. And they're like, true. A bad That's decision so that they made.
Yes.
They're like, now they're trying to turn, like, isn't it good that we squashed that? And they're trying to profit even on their shit decisions.
That, yeah, I never even thought about it like that. But it's like, yeah, they're the ones who stood in the way of an interesting
they're idea. Like, look how cool it was. We stopped that.
There's nothing we didn't let happen because we were too scared to do it, you know?
Be like, that's not like The Flash. Be like, obviously, like, you know, we went to go watch it, but then I did feel like the flush after, but I shouldn't have supported this.
I can't help it.
Yeah.
I'm addicted. I felt like the girl in Talk to Me when she's holding the hand.
Yeah.
I'm like, please, 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 please. So it was every time I watch a superhero movie.
It's like, I've always wanted a Flash movie. Yeah. I was willing to give it all up for the Flash
movie.
10
years ago. Yeah. Oh, The Shape. This has come out 10 years ago when I wanted it to.
Trust me, when the show first came out, I was there.
Huh? Yeah, exactly. Oh, man, I loved me some Arrowverse in the first couple seasons. But anyways, so with this movie being so prevalent to the times right now, I thought, what better time to do this?
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to be a full spoiler episode. I mean, this is a fucking 31-year-old movie now at this point. So go watch it. It's on Max if you can. And, you know, there's many other ways you can attain this movie, right? Because what better time to stick it to the studios and to not actually, you know, pay for the movie,
right? Yeah, do no streaming. Go buy it from Janice, right?
Yeah.
Or go buy it from Criterion, too.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, if you want to support it the right way, buy it from them, right?
I know. I don't think Disney owns Criterion.
Not yet.
Right? I don't think that's one of the few things. No, not profitable enough for them.
Apple is apparently discussing the idea. They're flirting with the idea of acquiring Disney.
The bigger fish.
There only needs to be one company, bro.
It's literally the 1990s commercial of the girl coming in with the hammer to hit Apple.
Yeah, it's funny. But so this movie,
back to the 90s.
Yeah, the reason I wanted to do it too, and I wanted to say spoilers, was because the bad guy wins.
Yeah.
Surprise. You know, the okay, so we'll give you a rough, just small plot of this movie, right? 25 words or less, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and let me go over the we're going to do a whole podcast about it.
Yeah, so. Studio exec is receiving threatening postcards from a writer that he may have
rejected.
Rejected. Goes to confront the writer, kills him, wrong guy, still receiving the postcards. So now he's in danger of losing his job due to competition while also dealing with this blackmail scandal, and he gets away with it.
I will say the other plus part about all that is that he bags a baddie. Somehow.
That is true as well. Yeah, he's banging the dead guy's wife at the end.
Some people have it all.
Yeah, this is a he has it all movie, you know? It's like the ultimate, like, I don't know if I've ever really seen a movie like this where the bad guy wins, because not even Thanos got away with it in the end, you know?
Yeah, you know, because we have it on in the background right now, something, just a point that I think stood out to me after thinking about this, that there's a lot of actors who just show up here that are just themselves.
65 cameos in this movie.
Of
cool, actors like playing
in
themselves.
Hollywood, like this is what happens in Hollywood, you know. And I mean, in a city like that, and especially in the 90s, I do think social circles of actors were probably a lot smaller, and they definitely, without the internet, social parties were probably crazier.
And yeah, that's true. I do think too, because this is a 90s movie and it's probably pre AOL at least.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That it's like you said, this idea of the Hollywood that's glamorized, of these social circles, right? Of like, oh, I went to a party. Or, you know, you would hear it like maybe your mom or dad or someone, they went to L.A. and, oh, I saw Brad Pitt at this cafe. Or, oh, I was passing by so-and-so and Shaquille O'Neal was filling up his gas tank at the hook-in.
Right, exactly. Like,
you know, and
now they can't do that.
It doesn't feel as special now, and maybe it's good that it doesn't, but I do feel like the 90s is probably that last era for that.
Yeah, because something this movie did remind me in that aspect, and like I said, because I compared it to Doctor Strangelove, is that it did feel like a studio in-house movie of like the olden days, because they had so many actors at their disposal, and because like very like Hitchcock almost, in terms of direction being the forefront of the film, but also having a full trust of a studio to let you use anything at their disposal.
Yeah, that's true. He did actually have full control over the whole thing, and that's probably for the better. We should probably talk about the screenwriter as well, because his name is Michael Tolkien. He wrote the book The Player, which he also adapted into the screenplay. And from my research, the book and the script are very, very different.
Oh, really?
Yeah, extremely different. The ending is totally different. Robert Altman had a huge hand in changing that. And we can also talk about Robert Altman a little more here too, because it was apparently quite unkind to Michael Tolkien. You know, he changed a lot of what he did. He undercut him a lot. And, you know, he used that director power and that Robert Altman name to kind of just bully him into making the movie that he wanted to make.
Kubrick fan. Which,
yeah, exactly. Which is honestly for the better. And I wanted to say this about Robert Altman, too. It's like, this is a guy who is kind of known for this. So not only someone who's going to have their fourth comeback is because they have problems with the studios, but he is just a, like a Tasmanian devil. You know what I mean? Like this guy, the drugs, drugs, attitude, very, very confrontational, you know, just a very mixed bag, a strong type A personality, right?
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about him at this time is that, like I said, he was an older man too. It's not like this is some young hot shot. Oh, you know, he doesn't really know what he's doing. He's all full of piss and vinegar trying to make a name for himself. This is just a guy who was known as an asshole
from the get-go.
And it's funny to say it now. It's like they couldn't exist today. But honestly, Robert Altman could probably not exist today because I think by his second or third film, he probably would have been canceled because he showed up to set, you know, high on whatever, you know, yeah, fueled by cocaine.
You know what with I mean? The one of the hardest fits I've ever seen, probably.
Yeah, so I don't know if you've seen his fits on the set of Popeye in Malta. Director Fitz has done a
it's the one with
the all white,
yeah, with the like
the
thing tied around his neck,
but no shirt.
That's the one I'm thinking about. Yeah. That thing is insane. That fits
fueled
insane
by cocaine.
Yeah, seriously.
But this is, yeah, so
America,
what better
baby
guy to make this movie, right, is somebody who's known for hating Hollywood. That is one of the things that is most known about Robert Altman is he kind of, you know, it's a double-edged sword for him. He wants to make these movies and he wants to create, but he also hates the environment that this thing cultivates, you know?
Exactly.
And an interesting thing about him as well is that he did a lot of TV work at a time when that was not popular. So I'm sure you know the show MASH, right?
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
That's a classic TV show that I feel like anybody who had cable in the early 2000s would definitely know what that is.
It always was on.
It's an old ass show, but I'm just saying for people of our age.
Always was on.
Always on TV, yeah, right?
And yeah, like just running episodes of it.
Yeah, like marathons, right?
Yeah.
And then also Tanner 88, which was another TV special that he did. He also did TV movies, too. So he was kind of at the forefront of, like, the idea of, like, if the studios are not going to let me do what I want to do, I will go to television where they're going to let me make long-form stuff. I can do whatever I want, and I'm happy to work within these parameters that they're giving me. It was a lot more of a give-and-take relationship than he had with actual Hollywood, which is interesting because
ahead of its time.
It is ahead of its time, right? So yeah, I mean, this is just a very interesting individual, and I do think it's a good time to do one of his movies because he's one of those like directors with a lot of allure, you know what I mean? Like there's just so much there to go into.
Yeah, and it always makes it interesting too, like I said, when there's not like a young gun story to it. So all of it starts from as a mature man, and maybe I think that's where the confidence comes from. And he wasn't really willing to bend over, obviously, in directions for the studios. And I feel like that's the only, a big reason why we're talking about him right now.
Yeah,
it's for like sure. His resilient, any of the directors that we do, I always feel like that's why we're sitting here talking about them, is because the same way we feel about a lot of the movies that we end up watching now by directors that are starting, these are sometimes directors that are forgotten by the masses, but have influenced so many more directors of the stuff that the masses do
for
like.
Sure. I mean, Robert Altman is a big name within the film community, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this is not a household name, really.
No.
Not if he was at one point, he's not anymore. No one is thinking of him the way they think of Scorsese or Spielberg or George Lucas or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Insert here. Even the newer directors who are influenced him, I would not say are household names either, right?
Mm-mm.
Like, you would think Paul Thomas Anderson would be, but he's not, honestly. If you ask your average Joe in the cubicle next to you, do you know who Paul Thomas Anderson is? No.
No, yeah.
Have you seen Boogie Nights? No, no. What's that? Have you seen The Master? Have you seen Punch Drunk Love? Have you seen whatever? No, right?
Yeah.
Have you seen Uncut Gems? No, right? Like, so these are not it's almost funny that even the people who he influenced also are kind of in that same boat as him, right? Because these are people making some of the best movies, but nobody really knows who they are.
Yeah, and I think that's what I wanted to get at is that, like, that's always those directors that we like so much and the reasons why, you know, we felt to make the podcast and highlight those movies, the new ones as they come out, you know, all the stuff we love with Christopher Abbott, that feels the same way, like, yeah. A very modern, like, those directors are what Robert Altman would have been then, and it's just cool to be around directors.
Dude, Christopher Abbott would be so good in a Robert Altman movie. Yeah. He really, really would.
It just, that's what I mean, like, it just ends up feeling like they're from the same, it's the same type of film, you know, or, like, it gives me the same feeling.
Sanctuary feels like it's a little inspired by the style of Robert Altman, not necessarily what it's about, but the actual, the craft of it.
Yeah, very. It's I think like one of the big things that I told you when I was watching this is like blocking, right? They always talk about the importance of blocking, and like this movie, or Robert Altman's style, honestly, is so hinged on that. And I think one of my favorite things about what I really like about him, especially in the one shot, or making it seem seamless, is a lot of like stuff going on in the foreground, which doesn't tend to happen, putting a subject behind a couple of things and having all that movement as they carry a conversation that you're interested in hearing. And yeah, that kind of reminds me also, because I know there's a lot of influence there too, is Quentin, right? Mm-hmm. Like the conversations that they're having between these studio execs, they seem like the type of conversations these idiots would have, and the type of projects that they're debating if they're gonna green light, and they sound terrible, you know? And so there's a lot of realness to this, but also the creative direction. It's almost like they talk about, like in Sanctuary, how he felt about it. Like, there's no need for this to go this hard, and it's going this hard.
Yeah. What I wanted to say, too, about Robert Altman with the stuff in the foreground, right, because that is a big piece of his work. I watched California Split the same day I watched The Player, and I have seen The Long Goodbye a while ago. But I don't remember it as well because I seen it very, very late at night, and I can't even be sure if I fully finished it or not. So, like, that's always one where I'm like, I've seen it, but I haven't really seen it, right? The stuff with the foreground, it's like, that's a really interesting way to build a world, right, that you don't really see in movies that often. And if you do see it now, it's like, oh, okay, this is where people are getting this from, right? And it would be interesting to go back even further and to see where he got this idea from, right? Because I'm sure some crazy-ass silent movie or some movie from the 40s or 50s already did it first.
Yeah.
But that stuff in the foreground, it's like, what am I even supposed to be paying attention to, right? Like, there is at some points, like, okay, like, there's, okay, the Burt Reynolds scene is the perfect example, mm-hmm, of this, because Burt Reynolds is in focus, and he's talking to this guy, this other studio exec, and then our main character, Griffin Mill, enters the scene, right, and then the camera pans in, it doesn't zoom in, it seems like it's pushing in, right, and it's pushing past Burt Reynolds, who's still talking to the studio exec, and then, you know, then the sound shifts, and it focuses on Griffin, our main character, right? And then, you know, his conversation is pretty fast. Once he leaves the scene, it goes back to Burt Reynolds, and it's like switching soundtracks, like, in a way that I don't really see sound used in movies that often, where you're having to really pay attention, but also at the same time, it's like, I wouldn't say that the stuff that Burt Reynolds is saying is exactly important, but it is more reflective of how the real world is, you know? It's like, he's building the world like it's the real world. Like, yeah, if me and you are going to have a serious conversation, there's going to be someone else talking.
Exactly. And that's like the influence of what we're talking about. The two directors, like Quentin Tarantino and Paul Thomas Anderson, that's what they took from his style, right? They understood those things. More Quentin, at least, to know that there's all of this chaos. And then the Safdies, too. That's what creates this environment that it does seem very chaotic. And I think kind of takes me to a point about this movie that I did feel like it was very quote-unquote genre bending.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
And I think it has to do a lot with his knowledge of doing that tension. I really did feel like there was tension in here of horror movies. Like horror movie tension.
There's a sequence with with the June Goodman daughter. Right? Say the bitch's name.
That's gotta be when I fuck up the name. You can't even say the bitch's name.
Oh man, that's just one of the most fucking classic line readings I've seen in a long time.
Of course,
so good.
One of the greatest.
But yeah, that really really great scene. That's just like pure Kino, right? It's like, this is pure cinema. This is something you can only have in a movie. It's like these two characters talking on the phone. He's watching her. She doesn't realize these beautiful mirror shots that are just blocked so perfectly. Even the pacing of the scene, too, and how the actors are moving along. You know, you don't for a second, like, not feel, like, just completely engrossed by it. You know, we're like, oh, I feel like I'm there. Like, I really do feel like a fly on a wall. And like you're saying, the tension, too. Like, why does this feel like a horror movie, you know, for certain points? And it feels like a thriller at some points. And, you know, this goes back to the opening shot as well. When you said, or when we said that it sets up the whole movie, you know, it's like, oh, is this a comedy? Yeah, it's a comedy. No, but it's also a thriller. No, but it's political. How political? Well, how political can it get? I don't want radical political. I want kind of political. Okay, well, it's political, but it's also a thriller. But it has a lot of heart, you know? And it's like, that's this movie.
It has a lot of heart.
Yeah. It's got to have heart, you know?
Yeah, I like that a little bit. I kind of actually wanted to comment, I think, what you said about the camera, too. That I think the camera also acts like what they talk about, the skill of making the camera a character. Mm-hmm. And that Burt Reynolds scene, and even the scene that we're at now where he's on the phone, always does feel like it. So we like zooms, you know,
obviously
a lot, but that it does seem here like there's a lot more pans. Like I said, full creative control of a studio where they built you a track, a rail, you know, and he has some shots in here where that's why the one shot can be achieved. Similar to, you know, what's the war movie?
1917.
Yeah. Where it's the one shot, right?
I get, yeah. It's just that's a bad example.
Bad movie.
That movie's like, the cuts in that are so cheap, they're like really obvious, you know what I mean? Where it's like, oh, this is where you did that.
Oh, but I was just going to say, in terms of being able to quote-unquote achieve that, that's the only comparison I was going to make, to be able to achieve that, because you have the studio's backing. Because that is something that's very hard to pull off.
You could have mentioned Rope, because that's mentioned in the
yes,
movie.
Yes, Rope, that's true. Yeah, and see, again, Alfred Hitchcock, that is a better example. Like, you know, Alfred Hitchcock being given like a studio system to do something like that. And I think that's when you get these interesting shots that this movie has. And also, yeah, one of my favorite scenes, like you said, they can't even say the bitch's name. When we were watching this, you kind of said he has a little bit of Bo in him, you know. Bo is afraid.
Oh, our main character. Yes.
Yeah. And in that scene, I did feel like there was a tension of Uncut Gems when he starts to get like red, like when he's really mad.
Yeah.
But it just focuses on his forehead,
you
and it's just
see him bubbling under the surface, and he's got this Tim Robbins. He has this like baby face, but he's also so menacing, you know. And like, he's so hard to read in this movie. You don't really get. You get so much out of him because he is pushing the story along so much by his neuroticism, you know, but also you can't put a pin in this guy, really, right? You're like, he killed somebody, but he doesn't feel bad about it, like, at all.
But he's also
like, not at all. But he is stressed about the idea that he could get caught for this, right?
Because he's not like a killer.
Because he's not. But then you're like, he killed him with ease, you know? Like, it was very, very just... In the heat of passion.
Yeah, but I brought up that line
today. The Wayne's World quote.
Yeah. Wait, if you kill a man. Oh, man. I don't even want
to. We got to make that a soundbite one day. That's a good one. You know, Wayne's World is kind of a similar movie to this in terms of it. Well, not only being hilariously funny, but the meta-ness of the movie as well, right? Because I don't know if this became popular in the 90s or something. It's not like this is the first movie to be about movies, but just the way it comments on movies, and like the same way Wayne's World does too. And it's like, you know, when he's crying at the end and he puts the water in his eyes and he's like, cue the Oscar music or whatever. I never learned how to read, you know? It's just like the small things like that. But what I wanted to, getting back to my point, that was a crazy little sidetrack. But getting back to my point here about Griffin Mill, you just don't understand this guy, right? It's like, he kills somebody, but he's not a killer. He's this movie exec, but you don't really know if he likes movies or not. And the reason I say that is because there is a few moments in the movie where he comes to the defense of the creative. So you do kind of want to believe that he is invested in like the art of movies, right? Because he also gives that speech later on in the movie. It's like, movies now more than ever, and we owe it to the public to give them good movies. But then there's just something about him where you're like, I don't really believe him that he really genuinely cares about movies. I think he cares about his position and his power and the money that comes with it and the lifestyle more than the idea of the art of cinema, you know?
Yeah, I think it's like the perfect reflection of somebody in that position, because obviously to have gotten to that position, you've fooled enough people to think that you do have movies at your core, and like that's the reason why you're at that position, and you've always cared about movies. But at the same time, these execs have different social circles, and sometimes they're not basing decisions off the creative anymore, because that's not the reality. They're basing it off of this, you know, in the aspect of this movie, it's a real crime that he's done. And I think it reminds me almost similar to American Psycho, in the way that, you know, there's this other world, other thoughts that are going in within him, but he's part of the elite. Mm-hmm. So what he's exposed to in those elite circles almost contradict what the, I guess, would be the ideology of being in these positions. Like,
you get that in that dinner, that lunch scene where they're in the like really nice, totally dated 90s like cafe, right? It's like Spanish style villa restaurant, right? Where the dickhead Larry Levy sitting at the table across the room with Angelica Houston, right? And he's like, can we talk about something else other than Hollywood? And that does feel very American Psycho, where it's this guy who is part of the elite, but he also hates them, you know, but he doesn't hate them enough to not partake in the way they live, you know?
And somehow he's like, you're the worst of them, because at least they're not,
they're happy with who they are.
Yeah. They're not discontent. I think, those are just similarities I see drawn. Like you said, these are all movies, that draw from each other. They're all similar themes. Like, I just think that has to do a lot with Robert Altman. Like you said, was around in the 70s. He was 40 when he started making the movies, which was when stuff started changing creatively, right? And for him to come in as an older director and still be able to apply what I think in hindsight is very revolutionary is, I think, kind of why he always felt maybe his confidence came from. And him being able to, I mean, a comedy like this or ideas like this, I really don't feel like
in 1947.
Damn.
So he's been around this is like for so long.
And this movie was made as 50 years or almost 50 years where he was directing.
Yeah. Like, what a touch, right?
And also, I mean, like, the reason why I think that's a crazy touch is because it's not like he sought his way to get older actors for this movie. He was getting actors of the time, you know?
So his first movie was 1957, so he must have done like TV and other stuff before that. But my God, what a long career, right? And I mean, The Player is amongst his best, mm-hmm. right? The big ones that he's really known for are MASH, right? You would think it's McCabe and Mrs. Miller, but that movie was actually very divisive at the time. Also, one of the big complaints about the time was that nobody could hear what was going on.
I did hear,
because that is where that style. I don't know if that's where he really started crafting or like honing that part of the craft of like, I'm going to start experimenting with sound design a lot more. But I've always heard that that is a complaint about that movie. But so I don't know if that is considered one of his best movies, like generally. But I know it is within the people who know. You know.
Well, I thought the one that he's known more is The Long Goodbye, right?
See, you would think that too, but not really.
Oh, really?
No.
Because whenever people bring him up,
he's this interesting character where it's like you would think like, oh, this is one of those bangers, right? Where everybody knows.
It's Three Wives,
no,
huh?
It's not.
It's Three Wives, isn't yeah. it?
So it's like it's MASH. It's the Nashville, right? Which is that probably
that sounds tight.
I think that is where he starts the idea of like the, and this is where Paul Thomas Anderson probably saw it too, is like the tapestry of making these big films that have like a shit ton of characters, a shit ton of dialogue, a shit ton of improvising, and just so much going on. Like, that movie is all improvisation with people who are not actually country singers and country stars. They're just actors who, you know, okay, I'm a country star for these 3 days or whatever that we're making this movie.
It reminded me of the...
That'd be a good one to do next for
the,
him.
The bit in the movie here that they're making, no stars.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, but then, so it's then it's the player, obviously. And then Shortcuts was his other one that
I remember
like
that
Oscar nominated and stuff like that. Yeah, so it's like he has like some really high highs, probably some of the highest, right? But then he has so much in between. And this is a guy who just liked to work, right? So he's making them whenever he can. And I kind of think it's more interesting when a director has like a good amount of misses. Because it lets you know that they were taking chances that, like, it's kind of pretentious that Quentin Tarantino is like, I'm only going to make a certain amount of movies because I want to retire at the top, right? And it's like, well, first of all, you've already gone past the 10 that you said you were going to make.
Yeah.
You keep changing the rules, you know, of like, no, actually Kill Bill's one movie. No, Death Proof doesn't count, right? So it's like, you've already gone past it, which is like, the allure is gone from that, right? You should just drop that. But also, it's like, the movies that he could make at 80 years old, like, he's going to have a totally different perspective than he does even at 60 years
old. Like Marty.
Exactly. And, I, you know, it's funny that you say Martin Scorsese, too, because he seems to be really in his bag right now with these stories that are, like, one, historical, two, to the general audience, kind of boring, right? Like The Irishman and... Silence, right? The other one that he did, and even now, like, the one that he, Killers of the Flower Moon. As much as I'm excited for that movie, I don't think the general public is going to look at that movie and be like, ooh, yeah, I can't wait to go see that.
Yeah, no, it's not going to have no Oppenheimer.
But this movie...
Well, maybe because of Leo, but yeah, I see what you... Yeah, it's not going to be the same.
I don't think so. Even Leonardo DiCaprio doesn't have this kind of sway, because, I mean... I just don't think he has the pool like that right now with this type of movie. You know, with The Wolf of Wall Street, it makes sense. You know, and even then, that was long fucking time ago.
Right era, yeah, that was 10 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, I'm saying that to say, like, the player too, to make a movie like this at this age, it's kind of refreshing too, because it doesn't feel very like self-important either. You know, like, I don't think that Robert Altman made this movie as like a fuck you guys. You know,
no,
because this is he's not as attached to this movie as you would think he is. He was like the fifth, sixth, I've heard anywhere from 5 to 6 to up to 10 different directors that they had went through. Like, Sidney Lumet was attached to this at one point. So it's not like he was their first choice either, you know?
Yeah.
And Martin Scorsese's at that point in his career where he's like, I'm picking the movie I make, and Apple's going to give me $100 million and let me use the IMAX cameras, right?
Yeah.
And Robert Altman's still like, I mean, if you want to hire me, I guess.
Yeah, I'll do it. You know? Yeah.
But it makes for a more interesting career overall, because he's just working with what he's got.
Well, I think that's why you quote-unquote don't become a household name. In the there's probably a lot of people who've seen something from him, they don't know that he directed, you know?
That's true. There probably is quite a few people who are like, do you know who Robert Altman is? No. Have you seen McCabe and Mrs. Miller?
Like, have you seen MASH?
Everybody probably who's 40 plus years old has seen
MASH. And like, they don't, like, there's people who might not know, like, that's Robert Altman, you know? And obviously MASH and this is completely different types of styles. He'd matured so much, he, like I said, he went through life and stuff, but there are certain directors like that I think transcend, that obviously they're able to stick around for that long because they have something. Because there's a lot of directors that, you know, for example, us, like a movie that I can think of, the guy who made Ennis Men, he's not going to make as many movies as Robert Altman made.
No, he probably...
Like, that long of a career.
Longer he'll make movies for.
Yeah. You know, and it's not, I mean, not trying to curse him or anything, but I'm just saying, like, there's a lot of times those directors or creative directors, they have their chances at making these movies and it doesn't go their way. And they don't necessarily have something that withstands time either, like a uniqueness to it, you know? Like, in all realness. Like, obviously, we were watching that movie for its style, but it reminds you of somebody like, you know, Robert Eggers already has that down, though. You know, you're like, there's always somebody else.
He'll be remembered even if he doesn't make a lot of movies.
Yeah, like already, you know. So, like, or like, I could see Robert Eggers having more a Robert Altman type of career. You know, like, he obviously has already been giving, like, he got like The Northman, but if it, like, that didn't do quote unquote good, like, it might, he might go back down, you know, to movies again. Other movies, and they might go do another big movie and it might not do good again. And that would remind me a little bit of, like, you know, Robert Altman just doing stuff because he can.
Yeah. So I think we should talk about the movie a little bit more, obviously. Mm-hmm. We could kind of just bounce around here. We don't really have to do a play by play or anything. We just talk about some of our favorite moments. I would like to talk about more of the genre bending, right? Just because this movie really does have it all. And one of the interesting quotes I like about this movie, because it's like, it's just encapsulates the whole film perfectly, is when Griffin is talking to June Goodman's daughter, yeah, right? And she's like, why did David's script not get picked up? And he's like, it lacked certain elements that we need to market a film successfully. And she's like, what elements? He's like, suspense, laughter, violence, hope, heart, nudity, sex, happy endings. Mainly happy endings. And it's like, that's this movie, you know? And it's like, I do love that this movie becomes like part of itself. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's like the movie that we're watching becomes the movie in the movie.
I think that the serious joke here would make me at the end be like, when I'm telling you, I sit on the movie and I'm like, it's just genius. It's to throw in your face, to tell you how predictable, how corny, how stupid, how unoriginal the writing all is, and give you a good movie with all of that in it.
Yeah, because there's like three, four times in the movie where the entire plot of the movie is just told to you by somebody.
Yeah, and they're, because they're pitching movies, and that's the excuse, right?
Yeah.
But I think that's what ends up like being the theme here, is that all of these movies are certain factors away from being good, because they all do have those common denominators. And Robert Altman's like throwing all of, like, look at all these studio execs. This is the stuff they look for, and I'm giving it to them, and they're gonna eat it up. And you guys are going to eat it up. And not in that way, in an offensive way, but it's just masterful that you could still throw it to me in my face and still make this great. And I think it's because, again, it's tackled, to, like, you know, it came off to me as a comedy. So it's making fun of itself,
yeah,
to a degree that only...
It is
a comedy,
but it is so much more than that.
Too. No, yeah.
It's like, genre, it's a noir, bending, you yeah. know? It's a whodunit mystery movie, you know? And it really is that at its core. So it's like, as much as it is a comedy, it is also a noir. But then it also has so much suspense and thriller elements to it that you kind of can't count it out as one of those either. So it really is a movie that has it all. Like, I don't really know... I can't think of something this movie doesn't have. Like, I've watched this movie twice now, and I think that this is a fiver. But I if you told me this movie was not good, like, I would just be like, you're not speaking the same language as me. Like, I don't know what you saw that I didn't see, you know?
This reminds me of another one of my favorite movies, Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
It's kind of a similar movie to that. Yeah. What was Roger Rabbit talking about at the end? What's Roger Rabbit really about? How the, what is it? The company that's making the freeways buying up all the
time. Yeah, exactly. They're going to make the freeway.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they took out the train system.
You know, and even in this movie too, there's one point where it's like, in a studio, the studio right now is susceptible to a takeover. And it's like, that's literally happening right now. It's yeah. like, it's this never ending story that is always the same. And, you know, I rewatched Babylon again this weekend. And it just goes to show you, too, it's like there's two totally different ways to approach making a movie about Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Because I would say that Babylon still does feel more hopeful and optimistic about the magic of the movies, right? But I don't feel like the player feels like that at all.
Yeah, because
it's
I would...
No, this is a nasty movie, and it's a nasty business, and the bad guy wins because that's... how life is, which is like one of the things in the movie, right?
Yeah.
It's like the movie in the movie that they're trying to make, this habeas corpus, right? This awful, habeas awful movie, corpus, right? Yeah. The writer keeps saying, like, it needs to be real because that's how reality is. And it's like, that's why the bad guy wins in this movie, because that's how reality is.
And then that was actually one of my favorite aspects of the movie, is it finally having to change because he was trying to keep the real ending. And then, like, it sucked. Like, when they screened it, nobody liked it. So then at the end, you know, even the artist himself has to bend to the studio, because what is your ego to make it? You're not going to make a movie that sucks, right?
He was happier to sell out and get the movie made and get the awards than to have made the movie he actually wanted and it flop and everybody says he's a hack.
Yeah, exactly.
And he was like, that's reality.
Right? Yeah.
Like, what happened to the ending? No stars. You were going to have a real ending. And he's like, what about it tested horribly in the audience?
Yeah, that's the reality. People that's didn't reality. Like it. Yeah. Like, and that
who's
is
going to want to watch this shit, right?
That besides is some us. Of the 50-50 part of it as the execs. Like, you get paid to make those decisions. And those are the hard decisions you make that are not pushed by art. Like, who is going to want to watch this? And I think in a time where movies were different without social media, and I think more people had attention, like retention of, you know, just media literacy, I would say, that movies like this, like they're like, no one watched them, was still more than what people watch now. Mm-hmm. You know, like, no one watched it just meant like, it wasn't the popular movie people saw that week, but people saw it still, you know? That's why these movies are being made more and more. And, like, this would, like, if this was the equivalent of now, this would be a movie that would be on Hulu.
Oh, that's so sad to think about.
Like, it'd be, like, I feel like that, this idea is, that's what they would give it. They would give it a TV series. It would be like Dexter, you know? Like, it'd that's be, the type of, like.
You know that movie there, that TV show they made about The Godfather?
Yeah.
They would make it that.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it'd be so dated. And everybody, like,
The Graduate
somehow
too.
It would look like a fake version of the 90s, even though, like, you could just watch a movie from the 90s. You know, and you're like, that doesn't look like the 70s.
It's The Graduate too.
Yeah.
And they all come back.
You know what they say about, like, those, the problem with movies now when they try to do 70s or anything that's, like, dated or whatever? And it's like, people are too handsome now. Like, you give me this actress with perfect skin and her fake veneers and her nose job and, like, I'll never believe that is someone from the 70s.
Yeah, seriously. She doesn't have yellow teeth.
Yeah. The way, like, a movie from the 90s, like, I think they don't look, I don't think they feel that dated. And maybe it's just because that's from the time, that's the time we were born, right? So we still have a very front of the brain fondness for this, you know? Like,
yeah.
I do remember when stuff looked like this. And my nostalgia, it's like, looks like The Player, you know, like movies looked like that. And that's how I remember movies looking as a kid. But you wouldn't really get that now, honestly. Like, there's too much of a perfect sheen to things, that there's no texture, you know?
Yeah, I
get
if
they were
you.
To make this now, like, the reason I brought up that the offer that Godfather shows, because, like, you go back and look at it, and you're like, too polished. But when you watch The Godfather, you're like, this movie's, like, dirty, like, physically dirty. The texture of it is gross, you know?
Exactly. And we, like, that sometimes obviously goes down to just the technicalities of how it was shot and sure, but I do feel like the environment those movies create, maybe it is, again, understanding the visual language, being like, I think we might have peaked with film, you know, like, in terms of being able to create an ambiance and, like you said, a grittiness to things that really stands out to us still now.
Yeah. I think we should kind of wrap it up soon, but do you have a favorite moment in this film? Like, one specific thing that just, this is why this is a great film.
Honestly, like, there's all the like moments you already glossed over, the comedic moment, but I do think I really enjoyed, not because I didn't know anything about it, getting the confirmation that he just bought himself out at the end of, like you said, he won, and also because the guy who was trying to blackmail him the whole time also sold out at the end. Yeah, you know what I mean?
That is true. I didn't think about it like that. So, but like, we were talking about it yesterday when we watched it, and, like, look, he just bought off the guy that had been, like, making his life hell for this whole time, but that was easy.
He was like, yeah, I don't write postcards anymore, and, like, he got away with it so they can make the story about what happened, and it'll bang, because we just watched a movie about it and it banged.
That's true.
That's yeah. like that's so the meta.
So fucking good.
There's this insane meta-ness to it, where, you know, anybody could make a movie that's meta like that, but not worry. It's like we keep getting in a circle about how it comments on itself, yet it's still really good.
And it's so easy to understand too, right? Like there's nothing confusing about this movie. Not that that's like an issue or anything, but it's just like so cut and dry. And it's like, it's so cut and dry that you can't even believe it is. You know, you're like, that's what they said was going to happen. And it's fucking happening. Be like, and it works, you know? Like, I'm not even like, oh, they already said that, you know?
Tim Robbins is also enough of a character for me.
He's so good in this.
That, like, where I don't super identify with him, where this is, like, it's going to stand out that it's him. Like, I'm always going to be like, oh, that's what he's
from. You know what's funny is that I've never seen The Shawshank Redemption, because, honestly, kind of cringe.
Kind of cringe.
I will never see him as that Andy Dufresne or whatever. To me, he will always be this. And, like, this is how I would like to remember him. I don't even know if I want to see the other movies he's in. I just will. I'm good with this singular performance of this skeevy fucking movie exec. It's just so, so good.
Because at the end of the day, he also has, like you said, a very neurotic nerd look to him. And it just really is, like, the perfect tone for this movie.
And he also has these moments too, though, where he's like super charming and he like turns it on, you know.
Exactly.
Like my favorite moment in the movie, like comedic wise, and I think it's because it's so perfect for the moment that we're in now, is when he tells Larry Levy when they're at the meeting, his welcome meeting, and he's like, "I was just thinking, what an interesting concept it is to eliminate the writer from the artistic process. If we could just get rid of these actors and directors, maybe we've got something here." And I'm like, boom, you know, like when I watched that the first time, I was like, this is why I fucking love this movie. Because we've talked about before that capitalism works in a way where it can make fun of itself if it's profitable to make fun of itself.
Yeah.
Right. But I don't know if you really would get this now, you know, like the reason I say that is because like with Babylon, right, which is like the latest in a long line of movies that just jacks Hollywood off, right? Even for the good and the bad, you can't hate it unless you love it, right? This movie really does feel just scathing, like in the way that you said Dr. Strangelove is, where it's like there doesn't need to be another movie about the inner workings of Hollywood. This movie nailed it. The same way there doesn't really need to be a movie about the ineptitude of our political leaders, right? Like, don't look up. You're useless, bro.
Like how we'll bomb each other.
Yeah. It's like, oh, well, they're not. No, trust me. We don't need this movie. This movie already did that. And it covers it perfectly. Same way Network with TV, right? It's like, you don't need to make another movie about this. This one already did that.
Agreed. I mean, it's... especially when like the influence of the movies that are being made are being drawn to like the originals. And I mean, that's kind of like what we have issues with in terms of, I guess this is kind of segueing way into like stuff that's current now, that like, you know, whenever they remake something like, oh, it's The Exorcist, they're reusing the same soundtrack, right? But why? It's already been, why don't you just tell people to go rewind?
You know, it hit me and you with the nostalgia and I'm like, I might.
Be like, but like with like the studio to be like, just remaster it. You know, be like, just show the first one again. Or
it's
like
true. Like just put the new put the old one in theaters.
And I do understand like, you know, the execs being worried about profit and also being like, the TikTok kid isn't gonna think The Exorcist is scary anymore. That's, you know, true. Because of the way that it looks. And like as much as I could appreciate it for his technicalities, an 11-year-old will tell me, like, that looks fucking fake as fuck. You know what I mean? Like, they'll be a smartass about it. And it's true, though, right? You know? And so, like, you know, as much as I love the thing, somebody can be like, that looks fucking dumb. Because now it does.
But yeah.
Exactly. And because I think, like, me and you got to understand, like, how much more work was put into stuff looking the way it did before. And how that is the language of cinema. That's the art that I came to see. That's the type of stuff, yeah, like for it to look that way and for it to be presented to me that way. So, you know, this movie just, again, I do think is just perfectly crafted. Very comparable to like only other movies that I absolutely love.
Yeah, it is really nice when a movie just jumps right to the top, right? You're like, this is, how did I not know about this? How have I not seen this? Like, anybody who's seen this and didn't tell me to watch this did me a disservice, you know?
Exactly. And I mean, yeah, I mean, that's why we have the podcast. That's why, you know, we talk about movies. This is a movie that if I didn't want to venture out the art of filmmaking so much and how I grew up, why would I know who Robert Altman is?
Yeah.
You know, but now it's like somebody who, you know, just really does enjoy the art and looks up to masters of it. It's like the more I hear about him, the more I feel like, you know, similar to, what is it, director, the Tree of Life?
You lost me there. Is it Lars von Trier? I'd never seen that movie. That's why I'm like so.
No, it's not Lars von Trier, but I'll bring it up right now. But I just think about him. He's your director's favorite director. That's my point that I'm trying to get at.
Terrence Malick?
Terrence Malick.
There you go.
So like say, yeah, I mean, like, so, but in terms of they not really appreciated too much, I say, by the masses, but definitely still enough inspired to not sell out for their ideas, and they end up lasting. Like, you know, like what we talk about, I think we've talked about it a lot, like Stanley Kubrick not being seen as what he is now when he was actually alive. You know, he's winning Razzies left and right when he was alive.
Hey, but Robert Altman also nominated 7 times for various different Oscars, never won, died, honorary Oscar. If that ain't a bitch, right? If that ain't Hollywood in a nutshell, love you when you're dead, right? You were a master. You were one of the best. Well, how come you never told me that when I was alive?
Exactly. Right? I mean, it's just like that's the trope of every artist, right?
Yeah.
You know, we know Picasso, but when he was around, they're like, who's this bum?
He did make a Vincent Van Gogh movie, too. So that's pretty funny. Yeah.
Yeah, see?
So
he's like, I understand.
That wraps it up for us. Like I said, this movie's on Max. Go check it out. Check out Robert Altman's work wherever you can find it. I would say don't expect it too soon, but this will probably be a director that we're going to go back to. This is just a fountain of film knowledge, and I feel like it made me a better film watcher watching a movie like this. So like, subscribe, comment. You know the drill. Bye-bye.
See ya.